Hello, and welcome to the Skeleton Factory Podcast.
Episode 69.
This is Adam coming to you from Austin, Texas. And today, I'll be taking a look at the 1978 John Cassavetes film, The Killing of a Chinese Bookie. Very excited about this. But before we get into the film, what is going on? Well, I've been keeping track of a documentary. I've heard whisperings about a documentary that's supposed to come out. I think this year, hopefully. And it's a documentary that comes to us from Unearthed Films, helmed by Stephen Biro. A lovely man. Met him over at the Texas Frightmare Weekend out in Dallas. It's a wonderful horror movie convention, and just sprinkled with all types of stars of horror and exploitation films, sci-fi films. I met John Carpenter finally. He could not escape me. I met Tom Savini, who looked like he wanted to escape me. But he was very cordial, of course. And I also met Andrew Robinson. Okay? If you're fans of Hellraiser and Dirty Harry, everyone knows Andrew Robinson. And, of course, it was a great pleasure for me to meet Mr. Ray Wise. So, he was a lovely man. Lovely man. Looking sharp, looking healthy, looking tan. And he was, great conversationalist, too. I think I have a video of him also eating his lunch, which I think he caught me filming him. So he kind of shot me a look, but anyways, I was there where I met Stephen Biro and Unearthed Films. I completely recommend if you're into horror, if you're into gore, splatter films, category 3 type films, things of that nature. The movies about serial killers, the occult, kind of gross foreign films. Go check out Unearthed Films, okay? Wonderful stuff out there, really good releases. And I got word that Stephen Biro is directing a documentary called A Serbian Documentary. And it's a documentary about the film, a Serbian film, the Sardan Spasojevic film. And also you can buy a Serbian film at unearthedfilms.com. If you've never seen it, it kind of carries the reputation that, say, like a Cannibal Holocaust carried for a very long time. It's kind of one of those films that has like a reputation, and then you see it, and it's and I think it probably lives up to its reputation. And here's just this is off of the unearthedfilms.com website. This is a description of a Serbian film, okay, for their extended cut that they sell DVDs and Blu-ray copies of. An aging porn star agrees to participate in a quote-unquote art film in order to make a clean break from the business, only to discover that he has been drafted into making one of the harshest films ever made. In order to escape his living cinematic hell and save his family's life, Milos will have to sacrifice everything, his pride, his morality, his sanity, and maybe even his own life. Release date to be announced. So, I think it was, if you're familiar with the original guinea pig films from Japan, there was, and actually, not just the guinea pig films, but also Cannibal Holocaust. There was actual police investigations into the making of those films. Okay? Because, you know, people, there's depictions of people dying and being tortured in those films. And certain governments, well, in the case of Cannibal Holocaust, the Italian government, and I would assume the Japanese government, I don't know if that's necessarily true, but both films basically were accused of being real, being actual snuff films. If you want to get into detail, there's actually quite a few books detailing the making of Cannibal Holocaust. There's one called Cannibal Holocaust and the Savage Cinema of Ruggero Deodato. And that's from, that's a book by the company Fab Press. And it's a very nice detailed book about the making of Cannibal Holocaust. And there's other books out there that talk about Cannibal Holocaust. You know, there's, let's see, there's a book called Killing for Culture, an Illustrated History of Death Film from Mondo to Snuff. That's, let me see. Who published that? It was, I believe, Creation Books. I don't know who's putting out that book now, but you can buy used copies online. But these sort of films that push the limits of taste and violence in films. And getting back to Cannibal Holocaust and guinea pig films, particularly 1 and 2. When people talk about the guinea pig films, they're really talking about 1 and 2. And, you know, the scenes of people being tortured seemed, at the time, so real that, you know, in Cannibal Holocaust, like Ruggero Deodato, producers of the film, like they had to go to court. They actually had to produce to the authorities, the actors, they had to verify that they were actually alive and not some poor people who were murdered on some island somewhere and left to be alligator food or something, okay, to clear their names. And getting specifically, segueing into a Serbian film and a Serbian documentary, the guinea pig, the makers of Guinea Pig, went to the trouble of doing like behind the scenes kind of footage, doing like a documentary about the making, about their film, which at the time was very cutting edge. No one was doing that then. So you got to see the, you got to see how the kind of special effects were done and how, you know, kind of how the sets were kind of staged and everything. And you can see, you know, basically it's a woman being tortured. That's basically guinea pig. 1 and 2, it's like you see like a couple of crazy guys filming themselves killing a woman and basically torturing her to death and dismembering her. And especially part 2, A Flower of Flesh and Blood, Guinea Pig 2, A Flower of Flesh and Blood, that's what it's called. And that one in particular, you see the dismemberment of a woman, and then ultimately her head is chopped off. And you know, all this stuff was captured in behind the scenes footage where you see the woman sort of, you know, the makeup people are putting like fake blood on her and they're all laughing and have a good time and whatever. But, you know, people thought it was real and people were very disturbed by it. But it's like the old mantra goes, just keep telling yourself, it's only a movie. It's only a movie. It's only a movie. And man, you got to tell people it's only a movie when you're talking about a Serbian film, which, you know, rubs the people the wrong way. A Serbian film, even if you're like really into horror films, you know, or if you're just into film in general, people are just like turn their noses up at a Serbian film, which I completely understand why. Okay. I get it. It's very, it's, it's a beautiful sort of exercise in bad taste, and it's very it's not a PC film. It's very offensive, but in the director is, you know, I mean, there's tons of interviews out there with him, but he's basically saying that, oh, well, this, and he's very calm and reasonable type of guy. He's like, well, this movie is just an allegory for kind of a Serbian family. You know, I don't know if he's referencing his family or just Serbian families in general or whatever. But to him, he seems very sincere about it, that it's sort of an allegory about Serbian families. You know, it's his interpretation of it. But, you know, and I don't know. It's I get why people absolutely hate a Serbian film, and I don't hate a Serbian film. It's definitely not a go-to for me. I'm not trying to watch a Serbian film during, you know, the month of October. You know, I don't have movie nights where I'm like, hey, guys, let's watch a Serbian film. You know, I mean, maybe I will. I don't know. I probably know some people who might be into watching it, but, you know, it's, but Stephen Biro went to the trouble to contact the filmmakers and was like, let's do a documentary about the making of that, because apparently they had tons of footage. There's trailers online for kind of teaser trailers for a Serbian documentary. And so there's interviews with the cast, director, okay, all the people involved. It looks very professionally shot. It looks like it's very well-made documentary. And they, you know, there's also tons of footage from the making of a Serbian film in the documentary. So that'll be really interesting to see. You know, being a person who's like, you know, I like a Serbian film. You know, I don't love it, but I like a Serbian film. I like what it, you know, and the whole thing about the allegory of Serbian families, of like, I don't know anything about Serbia at all. So I don't know what's going on there. I don't know the political climate. I don't know the socioeconomic minutiae of things. I have no idea. I know nothing about it. So, you know, just looking at the movie for what it is, from some guy from the United States watching it, I appreciate it being a high-budgeted exploitation film. And it came out at a time where there were still, like, mainstream torture porn, you know, your Saw movies, Hostel, stuff like that. I mean, those are mainstream movies, right? And they feel like popcorn, date, cringy, gross-out films, you know? Played in thousands of theaters all over the country, you know? And I think a Serbian film is sort of a step up from there, because clearly it's like the disturbing movie iceberg, if you're familiar with that internet phenomena. There's actually a documentary coming out about the disturbing movie iceberg. I don't know when that's coming out, but I am looking forward to that. Basically, disturbing movie iceberg is this thing that somebody made online, where it's basically this graph, and it basically shows like a picture of an iceberg, you know, like a side view, where, because the tip of the iceberg, as the saying goes, is you just see the tip of an iceberg, but the iceberg goes underwater and it continues, and it's much bigger the deeper you go. Okay, it's like a mountain. An iceberg is like a mountain, but it's, you know, you only see the tip of the mountain of ice, right? It's everything else is sort of hidden beneath the darkness of the water. So imagine an image of that, and then there's sort of movies are ranked from like the very tippy top of the iceberg, which is like mainstream horror films, you know, beloved mainstream horror films. Okay, you got your Friday the 13th, you have your Child's Play, your Friday the 13th, stuff like that. And then you go a step below that and you get into kind of mainstream still, but like torture porn type of stuff. You know, you have your Saws and, you know, your Hostel movies, things like that. And then once you start going down, it starts, you eventually get into things like a Serbian film. You get into your traces of death. You get into, you know, things that are essentially like Asian fetish porn films, guinea pig, cannibal holocaust, things like that. And that, and those things are not even at the lowest level. The lowest level is the deepest, darkest stuff that you can watch. I mean, according to the iceberg, and it is pretty, everything at the bottom level of the disturbing movie iceberg is pretty disturbing, and it's very gross, and it's real. It's all actual footage of, you know, beheadings and car crashes and, you know, people on fire and things of that nature, terrorist groups making terrorist type videos, if you catch my drift. Okay. And there's gonna be a documentary about the disturbing movie iceberg. And I believe it's called Going Beyond the Disturbing Movie Iceberg. I don't know when that's coming out. I think it's coming out this year, I think. So yeah, if that sounds interesting to you, the movie, as far as I know, as of this recording, there hasn't been an official release date. But if you go to putrid_productions at Instagram, there's a gentleman there named Jonathan Doe. He does stuff on YouTube. He produces his own films, and one of them is going to be Going Beyond the Disturbing Movie Iceberg. So, yeah, go check out his stuff. He's an interesting dude. He has a podcast called The Uneasy Terrain Explorers Club. And, yeah, so if you're into those type of movies, he's kind of a good source for somebody who's into that type of film and is also making his own kind of independent stuff, including documentaries, which is really cool. And from, let's see, there was a post on Instagram, the Petra Productions Instagram, where I believe he said that he interviewed Stephen Biro for the, for that documentary. So, but yeah, Serbian documentary. Still no future, you know, release date. But you know, no future release date. But yeah, he posted something online about it on Instagram and went 3 days ago. Okay, so I can't believe I talked for 20 minutes about how hyped up I am to see a Serbian documentary. Anyways, let's go ahead and smoothly transition into today's film. The Killing of a Chinese Bookie from 1978, directed by John Cassavetes and starring Ben Gazzara, who is a Cassavetes regular. You can see him in such movies as Husbands and Opening Night. Ben Gazzara, like Ben Gazzara, you may recognize him from the movie Roadhouse, as the dastardly Brad Wesley character. He's like the big, big, mean, rich man that, you know, he's our big bad guy in Roadhouse. So that's Ben Gazzara. Also, I should probably point out, since I'm mentioning Roadhouse, one of the characters in Roadhouse was played by a recently passed away pro wrestler named Terry Funk. And I grew up with Terry Funk, and Terry, he died August 23rd, so just a few days ago. And Terry Funk was, growing up for me, he was sort of everywhere, you know. He was, you know, he not only did a stint in WWF, you know, he was in ECW, he wrestled in Japan, He wrestled in, my God, NWA and WCW. He was everywhere. He was very old school. He was sort of the guy who was kind of an innovator of the hardcore wrestling genre. And yeah, that's a bummer, man. I mean, it's for me, it's nice to see a wrestler who didn't die before the age of 45. So, you know, Terry was 79 years old. So, yeah, and Terry Funk was in the movie Roadhouse with Ben Gazzara. So rest in peace, Terry Funk. And Ben Gazzara, actually, and if you want to have a nice Ben Gazzara movie night at your house, in 1998, Ben Gazzara made a real splash as smut businessman Jackie Treehorn in The Big Lebowski. He was also in Todd Solondz's Happiness, also from 1998, starring the Philip Seymour Hoffman. Another guy, rest in peace. And also Buffalo 66. He was the Vincent Gallo film. He was Vincent Gallo's dad in that movie. So yeah, there you go. There's a nice Ben Gazzara triple feature right there. Big Lebowski, Happiness, and Buffalo 66. So in case you're wondering who Ben Gazzara is, he's he's Jackie Treehorn. All right, so the killing of a Chinese bookie. So Ben Gazzara plays our protagonist, Cosmo Vitelli, the owner and operator of the Crazy Horse West, a club on the Sunset Strip in Los Angeles, California, USA. And the club is sort of on the skids, okay? Business is kind of slow when we enter the film, and we get a fly-on-the-wall look into the Crazy Horse West, okay? It's a striptease burlesque club, and it's sort of perfectly depicted, okay? It's not some glamorous Moulin Rouge, girls, music video strip club, okay? It's like a bar from Mean Streets or something. It's kind of run down and old. Looks like a place you'd go play bingo or attend an AA meeting or something. So instead of a straight up typical lap dance titty bar with VIP skyboxes and bachelor parties, Crazy Horse West is like a cabaret with scantily clad topless women, you know. Classy, I suppose. But also, even at the time it was made, would kind of probably seemed a bit outdated. So we open with Cosmo paying off a sizable gambling debt, okay? So he meets up with this guy at a restaurant and just gives him a big envelope with cash. This guy, I'm assuming, is a loan shark of some kind. Possibly a bookie, you know? Not long after this, Cosmo meets this mobster guy named Mort, who's played by Seymour Castle, who's also a Cassavetes regular. Okay? He's also, actually... actually happen to have it over here on my shelf. He's also in this movie called In the Soup with Steve Buscemi and Jennifer Beals. I've been wanting to watch this movie for quite some time, and he stars in it, so I'll probably end up watching this week. And if I feel it's appropriate for the show, I'll talk about it. But so yeah, so Seymour Castle's character of Mort, and Mort and some of his friends stop by into the Crazy Horse one night, and Mort and Cosmo start to chat, and Mort invites Cosmo to his club. He has a club that he owns. It's sort of this private card room specializing in just like poker games. Okay, and Cosmo, takes some of his girls over there. He goes and plays some poker. He's not particularly a good gambler, as you may have guessed by him paying off a bookie in the beginning of the movie. But Cosmo quickly racks up a $23,000 debt in one sitting, okay? Because Mort gave Cosmo sort of a line of credit, kind of like play money, essentially. But, you know, but whatever, that amount was, Cosmo clearly gambled that away and much more. So I looked into it because I just had to know. $23,000 in 1978, adjusted for inflation in 2023, which is the year it is right now. What is $23,000 adjusted for inflation in 2023? It is, and hold on to your hats, $107,835.78. That is a lot of money. So now Cosmo is sort of, he owes money to Mort and his group of friends. They're all like mob guys. Okay. Now he's sort of in their pocket now. Okay. He owes kind of big. And I should kind of point out sort of, who is Cosmo? He's this guy who owns this titty bar in LA. But Cosmo is like not a creep, okay? I mean, he's kind of a lazy businessman who doesn't get that people just want hot, naked women seductively grinding on their laps with their naked bodies in exchange for cash stuffed into their thongs. Okay, he's trying to have a bit more of a classier joint, and the ladies that work for him, they love him. And he's a sweetie to them. And he's even dating one of them. You know, so they establish that he's not some creepy, slimy strip club owner, okay? He's loved by the people that that work for him, you know? And he doesn't seem mean-spirited or, you know, like he doesn't seem like a scumbag. He actually seems like a pretty nice fella. But he has his vices, clearly. Okay, very relatable. So, it doesn't take long before Mort and his mobster wise guys show up to the club. They pull Cosmo aside. Okay. They all sit him down at like a diner. And they offer Cosmo this. There's like a proposal they have for him, okay? They're like, look, you owe us a lot of money. And Cosmo's basically like, I can't pay it all right now. But maybe we can work something out. He's like, you know, you'll get your money. I just don't have it right now. So they're like, look, there's a Chinese bookie named Ling. And the mobster wise guys, they don't like Ling. Okay. For whatever reason, and they want him murdered, and they want Cosmo to murder this Chinese bookie, and in exchange, the $23,000 of debts that he racked up playing poker will be forgiven. It'll go away. You know, your debts are settled. Just go take care of this guy for us, and we're square. So, I mean, that's how student loan debt should be, quote unquote, forgiven in America. Just send people who refuse to pay back the money they owe to the federal government. Like, have them carry out sort of like black op assassinations, send them to war, things like that. Just those are the people, because I believe we should have a volunteer army. But it's like some people are like, we should institute the draft again. You know who you should draft? People who owe money and won't pay. I mean, if you're already paying off your debts, great. But if you're just like, you know, your student debt gets passed along from debt collection company to debt collection company, then it's like, guess what? We're going to shave your head, put a rifle in your hand, and dump you off in some fucking country. Okay? That's what I would do if I was president, okay? The first wave of American soldiers to fight back Russians in Ukraine should be deadbeats with college degrees. Okay? Adam, we don't have American soldiers fighting in Ukraine. Not yet. Not yet. And these people are deadbeats. Okay. And by deadbeats, I mean women between the ages of 35 and 49. That's who primarily owes the most money in student loan debts. Okay, I looked it up. Don't dispute me. It's women between the ages of 35 and 49 with college degrees. Anyways, so Cosmo knows that he can't say no to these mob guys. Okay? It's like, you don't have the money, dude. You're out of options. Okay? And you don't want them to come up with other options like, how about we kill you and throw you in the fucking river or something? You know, that's not an option he's probably willing to explore. So Cosmo knows he can't say no to these guys. Okay? Because, you know, what do mob guys do typically in movies? They will, if you don't have the money, they'll just take things you own. Remember the Sopranos episode where Robert Patrick, you know, the T-1000, he owned like a sporting goods store, and Tony just started just basically like embezzling money from him. It was basically protection money. He's like, I need a fucking, listen, T-1000, I need bags of cash every month. You need to pay me. And then he basically just tapped out fucking the T-1000 for all his money, and then his fucking sporting goods store shut down, okay? Cosmo doesn't want that. He doesn't want the mob taking over his club, okay? And they could probably do that. You know, if things escalated, they could probably take the Wild Horse West. They can take his dancers. They can take his life. So Cosmo's out of options. So Cosmo agrees, eventually, to kill the titular Chinese bookie. So there's a scene where the mob guys smush into a car with Cosmo sort of like crammed in the middle, and they give him they basically give him the rundown. Okay. They're basically like, look, here's all the details of killing the Chinese bookie. Here's a gun. It's untraceable. Behind us, there's a car parked. That's the car you're going to take. This is the gun you're going to take. Here's a map giving you MapQuest quality directions to the guy's house. We've marked off exactly where you're supposed to go, all the exits and whatnot. Here's a notebook. They don't show the notebook, but there's a notebook. Here's a notebook, and it tells you step-by-step instructions of what to do and when to do it. Step one, shoot and kill Chinese man. Step two, run away. Since we don't see the notebook, that's what I'm guessing it says inside. So the bookie has highly trained, man-eating Doberman pinchers surrounding his property. So they tell him, go pick up some burgers ahead of time. Make sure they're unwrapped. No ketchup. No pickles. No onions. No soda pop. No Frenchy fries. No milkshakes. Oh, and here's a key to the guy's house. We have a key to his house. You might need this. Oh, yeah, and the place is crawling with armed bodyguards. Okay, good luck. So, it seems interesting because it's like the biggest, most like scripted chunk of dialogue in the whole movie. You know, there's not that the movie's like completely silent or anything, and there's people talking the rest of the movie, but just this weird condensed explanation. I don't know if Cassavetes did that for the audience. This movie is a bit more in genre territory. You know what I mean? It's got that film noir. It's got some action-y elements. Okay, it's you know, pew pew, people shooting guns at each other. And, you know, so it's got all that kind of stuff going on. But just this sort of like exposition of like, okay, audience, this is what Cosmo needs to do in the next handful of scenes that are coming up. So I don't know. I find that was a little weird, but so after this, they send Cosmo on his way. They're like, okay, go kill him. So after this, we follow Cosmo on his route to the bookie's house. Okay, and a bunch of stuff takes place. You see him, you see him get the hamburgers. You see him fucking go to the guy's fucking house. And okay, so finally he arrives. He sneaks into the house, and he murders the Chinese bookie. Okay. Nice place. You know, he's sitting, he's got this nice big hot tub, huge hot tub, massive. And Cosmo just walks in, it's just the two of them in there. And the guy's just like, he starts to talk, where the bookie that is, and he's like, oh, I've been very bad. I've been very bad. And then Cosmo just shoots the guy. And you don't see him shoot the guy, you see Cosmo's face as he shoots the guy. Okay. And then, you know, boom, you made a gunshot. It's going to alert people. So now Cosmo needs to get out of there. So he does get away, but he's like under gunfire. He's got to run. And he ends up taking a bullet in his side, his side of his abdomen, I guess. Well, I guess the side where your liver would be, I suppose. But the severity of the wound is kind of vague. You know what I mean? It's not like he's like, ow, my side. He's able to like sprint off, jump into a bus, and then jump off the bus, and then jump into a cab, and then jump into another cab. And so, I don't know. Maybe the bullet went in and out. I don't know. So Cosmo eventually gets back to the club. Meanwhile, the mob guys catch wind that the Chinese bookie is dead and Cosmo got away clean. So Mort and the mob guy should be happy about this, right? No, they shouldn't be, because the mob guys kind of double cross Cosmo in a way. The mob guys figured that Cosmo would have been easily captured and killed by the bookie and his bodyguards. They figured it was a suicide mission. Maybe he'd get the guy, maybe he wouldn't, but he'd probably get killed in the process. But that didn't happen. Okay? The bookie gets killed, and Cosmo gets away. So, and they don't like this, because that's going to arise suspicion that they're involved. Also, the bookie, this is very important, actually. The bookie was, in fact, not a bookie. Named Ling. He wasn't a bookie at all. He was actually some guy named Benny Wu. Who's Benny Wu? Benny Wu, according to the movie, was like the head of, he was like the main Chinese shot caller for whatever the Chinese call their mafia. So it's like the triad. Benny Wu was like the main dude of like the entire West Coast. Okay. So Cosmo whacked a maid guy and didn't even know it. It's not good. So, displeased with this outcome for some reason. So Mort goes and tells the creepiest looking mafia hitman that you've ever seen, the character Flo. And he goes and tells Flo that he has to go kill Cosmo. And he goes and tells him, like, turns out he did end up whacking Benny Wu, but he made it out alive. So now we need you to go kill Cosmo. So, and you need to do that ASAP. So Flo goes by the nightclub where Cosmo is. It's not like Cosmo's trying to hide. He goes to the club and he swoops up Cosmo and he takes him out to this like abandoned warehouse. And he's basically like, he's trying to kind of, you know, he's trying to deceive him. He's like, come out to this creepy abandoned warehouse and come tell all of us about your harrowing tale of killing Benny Wu. We want to hear all about it. And Flo is an interesting, very fascinating character, albeit his kind of short amount of screen time. But you see him around. Every time the mob guys come around, he's always in their little group. But, you know, after Benny Wu is killed and then he's tasked with murdering Cosmo, you know, we get these really good scenes with Flo. And there's a scene where he confesses that is sort of he's taken a shine to Cosmo, that he likes him, and given Cosmo was set up and the fact that he pulled off this impossible task of killing Benny Wu, because the mob guys tell him, like, we haven't been able to get to Benny Wu. Well, when they were like this bookie, quote unquote, we haven't been able to get to this kind of low level bookie guy because his house is fortified and he's got bodyguards and dogs, and you know, it's so it seems like Flo was actually kind of impressed that Cosmo was able to pull this off, and he expresses that, you know, because I imagine of all the people he runs into, all the kind of scumbag mob guys he's affiliated with, that there's just something about Cosmo he likes. And you can tell he feels conflicted about having to kill him. And Cosmo realizes at some point, like, I don't think Flo can kill me. I don't think he wants to do it, and I don't think he's gonna do it. So Cosmo tells him, like, hey man, maybe you should just leave. And Flo does. He ends up like, you know what? I think I am gonna leave. And which is really unique. You know? It's like mob guys are always like they fucking, you know, in movies, they're sort of, they're like these drones. They're just like, okay, you whack the guy and then you disappear. You know what I mean? There's never like they get to the point where they got to whack somebody and they just let someone go. Like, that's kind of a unique spin on the kind of typical mobster guy character. So Cosmo tells him to leave and Flo does. So basically, Flo is burning his mob buddies. You know, they told him, like, we need you to go kill this guy. And then he's just like, well, I'm not doing it. So on the way out, Flo runs into Mort, who's pulling into the warehouse. And he tells him, like, you take care of my friend in there. You know, this is your problem now. If you guys are going to kill him, do what you got to do. He's like, but I'm not going to have any part of it. And then he gives Mort the creepiest smile you've ever seen. Okay, like Art the Clown from Terrifier level creepy smile, and then he drives off. And Mort pulls in and he tries to convince Cosmo that that he can help him. He can help him get out of town for a while, let things blow over. The wise guys can run his club in the meantime, and when it's safe to come back, you know, he can come back and things will just go back to the way they were. You know, he's feeding him this little fancy tale that's probably not true. Okay, Cosmo knows that these guys want to kill him. So Cosmo, and he knows that there's other mob guys. If they're not already in the building, they're coming. So Cosmo can smell a setup. And he just fucking kills Mort. He lets Mort have this, like, He lets him just have this whole fucking scene where he's just like, I can help you, I'm your friend, blah, blah, blah. And fucking Cosmo doesn't even say a word. He just he's sitting in the car. Mort's sitting in the car with, like, the door open. And Cosmo just slams the door and fucking kills him. Shoots and kills him. So, but lurking in the shadows is one of the mob guys, the character of Phil, played by Robert Phillips, who you'll know as Chief Palin from the movie Mitchell, the movie made famous by Mystery Science Theater 3000. And if you're a MST3K fan, you know that the Mitchell episode is the last episode where Joel, the character of Joel Robinson, that's his last, his final episode before he escapes the Satellite of Love. So yeah, that's who Phil is. Phil is, you know, Joe Don Baker's character in Mitchell. He's Mitchell's, you know, chief of police guy. So Phil shows up and he's there to kill, because Mort's not really like a trigger guy. So Phil is there. He's there to kill Cosmo. Okay. So then a game of cat and mouse begins. Okay. They're in this empty warehouse. It's just the two of them, and goes on for quite a few minutes, and he's trying to find Cosmo. He's trying to lure him out into the open so he can kill him. But Cosmo manages to avoid detection and escapes. So it's one of those scenes, like many of the scenes in this movie, where there's like a situation will occur, and the resolution to that situation doesn't, like, never comes. Okay? So Cosmo's able to get away, but it's like, well, he just killed Mort. And this guy, Phil, who's one of the mob guys, is trying to kill him. You know? But it's like, it's like, what happens after that, you know? Well, we actually never find out. We don't know where that part of the story leads. It kind of stops right there. So, still, with a bullet still stuck in the side of him, Cosmo, he gets away. So, still with a bullet in him, he gets back to the club. And he gives this speech in the dressing room with the dancers who are, like, getting ready. Okay? And it's this whole thing about, I don't know, it's sort of, I think the kind of morale in the room is low, okay? Cosmo was dating one of the dancers, and there's a whole chunk of the movie that's sort of about his relationship with his girlfriend, stripper girlfriend, and her mother, and sort of that whole thing. And, you know, the dancers and performers ask, like, well, where's she at? Where's your girlfriend? And he's like, she's not coming back. She ended up getting another job and yada, yada, yada. So, and everyone in the room is kind of, you can tell they've been kind of bickering with each other and whatever. But so he kind of comes in and gives them like this motivational speech sort of thing about to be happy and to be comfortable. We have to be a character. We have to be what makes other people happy. And it's hard work to become comfortable. So become your character. And he kind of means like all the dancers, they actually play characters on stage, you know, like become the character you're supposed to play. But he also means that in real life. Like, become the character that will get you to a point where you can be comfortable. So basically, like, fake it till you make it. It's basically what he's saying. Become your character, right? And in Cosmo's case, he explains that sort of confesses that he's happiest when he's angry, when he's sad, when he can play the fool, when he can be whatever. Other people want him to be. And my takeaway from this is, if you want to be comfortable, you have to work for it, you know, and you have to kind of at the same time be masking your fear and insecurity. You have to pump up those around you. And if you're lucky, you can one day enjoy the spoils of truly being yourself instead of hiding behind a mask. And it's not about money. Okay, money is not what Cosmo means by comfortable. He's like one day you can get to a position where you can just drop the facade and just be your true self. But he's like, in the meantime, you're better off just not doing that, because your true self will probably not get you to a level where, you know, you're financially secure. And basically, you know, it's kind of just fake it till you make it, and maybe you won't go crazy. Yeah. suppress all your depression and anxieties and things like that. So what he's saying is, like, it's not about money. So money in this world is like firewood for a campfire at night in the wilderness. It's like, sure, it keeps you warm, boils your water, cooks your food, but it also gives you light and keeps the wolves and the, you know, hidden in the darkness away. So money in this movie really is a nuisance, okay? Anytime money's even mentioned or anything, like, it's always like a giant pain in the ass. It's no one's ever experiencing this comfortableness that Cosmo's talking about. So really, this whole idea of being comfortable is kind of this delusion that Cosmo operates under. But he also uses that delusion to kind of pump up his performers so that they go out there and work and make money. So yeah, in this movie, money's a nuisance. Cosmo needs it to maintain the club, to fuel his gambling habit and his lavish lifestyle, and keep the mob away from him. And the mob guys, you know, they want to kill their competition in this case. It's Benny Wu. That's their competition. They want to kill him so they could take his business so they can get more money. Even the hitman, Flo, has a scene where he talks about money. It's like the scene, he kind of has this scene where he's like, you're not sure if he's going to kill Cosmo or not. And he's kind of, it's almost like he's talking himself out of killing Cosmo. And he has this really great scene where he talks about money being like being God. Money is God, but an angry God. And even goes against his hitman duties. You know, he's basically like money turns people bad. You know what I mean? He's basically like, I get paid to kill people, but money doesn't make me happy. Killing people doesn't make me happy. I get my money from killing people. Do you think that makes me happy? It doesn't make me happy. You know? So he walks away from the money. He walks away from doing what he needs to do. He drops his mask. You know? He drops his facade, you know, and lets Cosmo go. Because he can see the good in Cosmo. Something you can't buy. Okay? No one's comfortable. This sort of idea that Cosmo talks about, people being comfortable, those are the people who are truly happy. It's just like, that's false. And I want to point out, this is kind of a weird observation. Remember when I said that Flo has that whole speech about how money is the worst? Basically, what is it? You know, money's the root of all evil, kind of the kind of thing. That's kind of what his speech was about. When he goes to leave the warehouse, Flo runs into Mort and he tells him, like, this dirty work you want me to do, it's your problem now. So you go do it. And then he makes that weird, creepy smile, almost like a mask. You know? So it's like, it's almost like he dropped his mask for a moment to become this guy who's like, you know what? You know, there are things more important than money, you know, and I'm not going to kill this fucking guy. And then he puts on this weird face, this weird mask before he drives off. So I feel like it's kind of like Cosmo's speech at the end, and things like that in the movie are very interesting. There's a lot going on. There's a lot that's being said about, like, what is happiness? Is it even attainable? Are we all just spinning our wheels? And there is that sort of feeling. Everyone in this movie feels like they're just spinning their wheels. They're just trying to get by. Everything is just like everything they do is just so much fucking effort. And everyone you run into is sort of unpleasant. In life, sometimes you don't get resolution. You know, this is like maybe you have an argument with somebody and then you don't talk anymore. And maybe you never talk ever again, but it's like that tension is still in the air. You know, you carry that around with you. You know? Life is like that, and this movie is like that. There's whole scenes where Cosmo has a falling out with his girlfriend, the stripper, and the stripper's mom. You know, in the beginning of the movie, they love him because he's able to put on that facade, that mask. You know, everything's fine. We're making money. Fuck it. Everything's cool. But really, it's like, everything is not cool. You know, and by the end of the movie, you know, they see him for who he really is. So, there's no resolution to that. There's no resolution to, hey, there's, the mafia is trying to kill you. Do they ever get Cosmo? We don't know. Also, Cosmo's shot. So he gets up on stage. You know, he introduces the crowd to his... we're going to have a new act this evening. Okay? We're going to have a whole new show for you guys. And then he kind of gives a shout-out to all of his workers. And then he gets off the stage and leaves. And you can't see his bullet wound. Okay? It's like he's wearing like a dark suit. You know, the club is dark. You can't really see it. Then he goes outside into the light. Okay? Under the marquee lights. He's standing on the sidewalk and you can see like he's bleeding rather badly from his side. He's not wincing from the pain. You know, you don't know exactly how bad his gunshot wound is, but it's like you can't just walk around with a gunshot wound forever, dude. So does Cosmo die? Does he end up succumbing to his wound because he refused the entire movie to even go to a hospital? Does he live? Does he die? We don't know. It's left up in the air, unresolved. And I think that's, you know, I think there are people who have frustration, especially like early, like when this movie came out, like reviews, audiences were kind of disappointed with this film. But it's like, maybe there is no resolution. You don't know how it ends. You know, you can make up the rest in your head. You know, maybe a movie wants you to feel frustrated. Because life's frustrating. And I actually enjoy the movie for that. You know? I don't need every little story arc and character's little thing to be all buttoned up in a cute little package for me. And that is the end of the movie. I don't necessarily need that. And that's why movies like this appeal to me. And I hope it appeals to you. Okay? So, you know, John Cassavetes' films... Typically, what he'll do, and I never went to film school, so I'm not the most eloquent when it comes to the fine details of what a filmmaker's thinking at any given time or anything like that. But from what I've noticed, John Cassavetes' films will attach you to good people who do bad things, and at times attach you to bad people who do good things. You know. Attach you at the hip. So characters may not find, you know, his characters may not find resolution, just like in real life, right? Though killing of a Chinese bookie is one of the most kind of genre-centric films that Cassavetes did, you know? And I think it works well in this film, you know? It's sort of his mastery of these sort of almost like pseudo-documentary cinema verite elements and making movies about people that are like you and I, okay? Doesn't do typical movie things. And typical movie things are cool, you know, like Casino and Goodfellas, you know? You can tell you're watching a movie. But Cassavetes will let the camera just linger on somebody. He'll let the room just chat, okay? You're not overwhelmed with the Rolling Stones, you know, things like that. So, again, attaching you at the hip with these characters, not knowing where they might take you, which I think is very exciting. You know, you follow around a character, like, where are they going? I don't know. But enough stuff happens throughout the movie where you're hooked. You're hooked to the hip with whoever the main character is. You know? And is in Cassavetes' influence is felt in movies like Safdie Brothers' Good Time and Mystery Train by Jim Jarmusch and Linda, Linda, Linda and Bad Boy Bubby and Talk Radio. All films that I've covered on this show and movies that I recommend. And I recommend this movie. So go ahead and check out Killing of a Chinese Bookie. I recommend it very much. I like it a lot. And go check out some of John Cassavetes' films. You know, and with that, that's the end of the episode, guys. Thank you very much for listening. I'm going to get out of here. If you need to get a hold of me, you can do so at Instagram at skeleton_factory. I'm also on Twitter, also known as X, at SFPodcastATX. And I'm also on Patreon at patreon.com/skeletonfactory. I have tons of free stuff there. I have audio and video shows, and it's the best place you can support the show. Okay, so you get all this stuff for free, but you can go there and monetarily support the show. It's very much greatly appreciated. Okie doke, end of plugs. Okay, guys, I will check you on the next one. This is the Skeleton Factory Podcast, rescuing your movie night one movie at a time. I am Adam. Bye-bye.